Morning.
Morning.
I see some people coming in. Is there any more room in here? Because it's kind of full. There are a few seats in here, you guys. So, Darla, if anybody more comes in, direct them into this room, okay? Okay, hi again. All right. So this morning I'm going to talk about the Zen of just being who you are, because somehow that got as a subtitle to my book. I don't know how that happened. I think probably she did it. So I thought, well, I'll make something to talk about. So that's what I'm going to talk about. So, impediments to being just who we are, impediments. And we get advice from Meister Eckhart about this. Meister Eckhart says, a human being has so many skins inside covering the depths of the heart. We know so many things, but we don't know ourselves. Why 30 or 40 skins or hides, as thick and hard as an ox's or bear's, cover the soul? Go into your own ground and learn to know yourself there. So, we are individuals. We are idiosyncratic. Each of us is weird in our own way. And yet, we have the entire universe here. The entire universe is here. But we don't know that. We don't realize that. We don't live that way often because our deepest heart, if you want to call it that, is covered by all these skins. All these skins. So I'm going to talk this morning about four skins. Spend a little bit of time on the first three and more on the fourth. So the first skin is memory ghosts. Anybody know about memory ghosts? Anybody ever had that experience of memory ghosts? Memory ghosts can be pretty strong in our lives, can't they? Pretty strong. So strong that when we see each other, we see each other through our last experience or the experience before that, or something really yucky they did to us 3 months ago, or something really wonderful they did 3 months ago. Well, that's fine, but if we believe those ghosts are real, we don't really encounter each other right now. We don't really encounter each other. So memory ghosts are pretty strong. And a story about that from my own life is that when I was a young man with my first teacher, there weren't very many of us, so I got to hang out with him as much as I wanted. And then all of a sudden we had a big monastery and people were coming in and things were different. And I knew a woman named Louise who started out as my friend. But after a while, it seemed to me that she was getting at least twice as much time with Suzuki as I was, maybe three times as much. And of course, I wasn't cute. And I didn't have certain features that she had. But so every time I saw her, she was not my friend anymore. I mean, I tried to make her my friend, but I only saw that ghost. And I didn't even realize what it was. But what it was, I realized later. Often it takes a while for us to realize these things. Sometime later I realized, oh yeah, Louise is kind of like my sister in some ways. And I was jealous my whole life that my dad gave more time to my sister than me. My whole life. And here it was playing out in this very calm monastery where we're all sitting zazen all the time and trying to be good. There it was. There it was. Memory goes. So it's hard to see people just as they are because of these ghosts. But possible. It's a skin that we need to just see and let peel away. Let peel away. Sometimes all we see is the negative ghosts about someone. And it's very toxic, even though they've forgotten all about it. We haven't forgotten. We haven't forgotten what they did, what she did, what he did. So it's hard for us to be with him or her. We want to, I'm going the other way. And that's not bad. That's the way we protect ourselves. These skins are a kind of armor to protect ourselves because we feel vulnerable. We feel vulnerable. But to know that, to experience that, to just be with it, this really Zen practice, if there is such a thing as Zen practice. And sometimes we've had wonderful experiences with people in the past. Beautiful memories, like our first date, our second date, our third encounter. And now, but the person is now bad tripping us all the time. We cling to that memory, hoping for that memory, seeing the ghost of the memory, instead of really seeing what's going on. So, this is part of our practice, seeing things. Hi, come on in. I'm sure there's a place to sit somewhere. Actually, there's a place for you. So that's the first skin, memory ghosts. The second skin is denial or continual apology. I'm calling that the same skin. You can do whatever you want. You know, I just made this up, so it's not out of the sutras. I know it's a list. The sutras do most lists. Do lists, but you know, I've been doing this so long that I thought, well, if they do lists, I can do lists too, right? So number two, denial or continual apology. So on the one hand, we deny sometimes. And these are, I don't think people do both of these. I think people do one or the other. Well, you could do both. Try to deny our fallibility. Try to deny our mistakes. Make excuses. Blame other people. Complain. Needing to always be right. So my grandson is 9 years old. He is trying to keep that six-year-old in line. You know, telling a six-year-old, the nine-year-old is always right. And so Logan doesn't have a chance to be right because the nine-year-old is developing his little ego. He's got to be right. But it does get fatiguing for the grown-ups who keep trying to intervene and trying to teach Ethan as he goes, no, you know. So we hope he'll outgrow that, don't we? But sometimes we don't outgrow that. I mean, I can remember being 19 and 20, and people saying to me, oh, I'm tired of hanging around with you because you always think you're right about everything. I thought, moi? Moi? No, you don't mean me. There must be another Tim. Well, that's my defensiveness, right? That's my defensiveness. That's part of always being right. You're defending. You're continually defending. I was smarter than the other kids. I used my intelligence to defend. I mean, it's smarter in a very superficial way, right? In a very skin way, not in a deep way. Or apologizing for who we are. Apologizing and apologizing and apologizing. apologizing to others, apologizing to ourselves. I'm not good enough. I could never get this. Zazen is impossible. Oh, apologizing. You did it right. I can never be like you. Apologizing. And then what happens to us? We live our lives for others. But your life is unique. It's okay that it's weird. It's unique. There's no one on earth that sees the same way you do. That's cool. As an individual, you're undivided. The more you just be who you are and stop putting extra heads on yourself, the more you settle into just being what you are, who you are, and divided from everything else. Right? Right? The third skin is being judgmental of others. So, other people have opinions we don't agree with, opinions that are really stupid, and their politics is really bad. Look at American politics. That's not your politics, is it? You don't want to have anything to do with that, do you? It is really bad, right? They have lifestyles. Jeez, the way they live, isn't it? they're just out of it, or they don't get it. So we become very judgmental, right? Very judgmental. We hang on to that skin. And hang on to that skin of judging others. Judging. Again, my 9-year-old grandson, he's always like, well, I was second in the class. I was third in the class. I want to be first. So he's always judging. John had given me more time, I could have done it. But you know, we do this at 19 and 29 and 39 and 49 and 59 and 69 and even at 72. Maybe at 73, it'll all change. So we're judgmental. So I was in Rotary Club a couple times as a skillful means. I won't say a skillful means to do what, but a skillful means as part of my job. And so I co-organized a trip to Guatemala to work with refugees from the Guatemalan genocide. This was like, how many years ago was this? Probably, maybe 12, 15 years ago. And so we as Rotarians went down, and what were we doing? Well, we took a doctor, and we were going to rebuild a schoolhouse, but mostly we took a doctor in medicine to refugees of the Guatemalan genocide who were living on the Mexico border. They'd been in Mexico, then the genocide abated and they came back across the border, but they were just living in nothing in the wilderness. So we went there to support them. And I was the translator, which is pretty good because I only can say about como está usted, basically. But I did a lot of that. And so I was assigned to room, and when I say room, we stayed, it was probably only a week or so, in these little hovels where we had a room and the toilet was right next to the bed, and you know, I won't go into the details. So I roomed with a guy named Bob from my Rotary Club, and I didn't know him, but I saw on the plane down that he had a book, and the book was about how we could have won the Vietnam War. And I thought, oh no, I'm going to be with this guy. And sure enough, he started talking to me about, in the plane down, about the military and how we gave in, and we da-da-da-da-da. And so I was not so happy. But I was the organizer of this trip. You know, he was living with me. I was trying to be gracious, right? But when he was living with me for that week, I began to see that he was a human being. That he come there because he was interested in helping. That he was a little more timid than I was. He had his camera, and he wanted to take pictures of everything. And he felt that people back at home would enjoy seeing those pictures. And so I just didn't say anything about the war or the military, and he became a friend. I mean, not my bosom buddy, but a friend. And later I got him on my board of directors of my nonprofit. And he was very generous for many years. But, you know, he had a family just like I did. He got scared in the middle of the night out there in the wilderness just like I did. He wanted to support people who were suffering just like I did. And it was before the Tea Party, but he definitely would be Tea Party. So we have these preconceptions, these judgments. And fine. But is it possible to just let go of them? We don't agree. So, are we just going to hang out with people we agree with? That's kind of boring, isn't it? Isn't that boring? If you just want to hang out with someone who you agree with, just play a tape of yourself talking. So, we're all in the same life situation together. And the skin of judgment is a skin that distances ourselves from going deep and opening up. So Jesus says, judge not, lest ye, however that is, what is that? Judge not, lest ye be not judged or something? Oops. I wasn't raised in that religion, you know, but something like that. Who knows what it was?
Just not, lest ye be judged.
Pardon?
Judge not, lest ye be judged.
Okay, there he is. Good Catholic boy, right, Dean? No, not a good Catholic boy. A bad Catholic boy? Well, okay. So the foreskin I want to spend the most time on, and one of Buddha's key teachings was transiency, everything changing, right? It's over and over again in the Pali canons. That's what he's talking about, one of the main things he's talking about. So control then, very thick interior skin, control. The outer skins of memory ghosts, self-aggrandizement, or self-apology, being judgmental. Those are important skins, but the inner skin of trying to control something that's continually changing, some world that's continually changing. That's a skin. A skin. So, about a year ago, I was on my way to work in the morning. That is when I had a job out there. Now I don't have a job out there. Now I have a job here. and I saw on the side of the road, not too far from my work, what was a fender bender. Two cars had hit each other. But the odd thing was that the people who had hit each other were out of the car and they were smiling at each other. They were smiling as they looked at the dents and as they talked, they were smiling at each other. And I thought, this doesn't make sense. This doesn't compute. They looked like they were friends. They looked like they were really good friends, smiling, still engaging in the problem. But And I went back to the office. I went to the office in the morning, and I said to a woman named Jill, who worked with me, I said, you know what happened? And I said, this was really cool, Jill. And she said, yes, well, you know, Tim, don't you think everything happens for a reason? And I said, oh, well, I don't think everything happens for a reason, but I didn't. But that was Jill's take on it. She was a good Catholic girl. And I don't know how that has to do with Catholicism. You guys tell me. I don't think everything happens for a reason. I don't mind if people say that, think that. But things happen. Everything happens. Everything's changing. And it's possible to accept with equanimity. Even something bad that happens. Equanimity. Whatever it is. That's when we start to let go of our need to control. Our need to control. So in the midst of this continual flux of everything, this unpredictability of everything, we can start trusting a little more. A little more. Till we trust in heart-mind, as the third ancestor said. We trust in heart-mind. And something where that's very vulnerable and yet very open and connected to everything. Connected to everything. As Meister Eckhart said, you go into your ground and learn to know yourself there. So, whatever happens, we can deal with it. We can deal with it. And with trust, change is opportunity. Even a fender bender is opportunity. It's opportunity. So, I've given this example. I only get to use this example one more time, I think. So, 6 years ago, I got Lyme's disease. I got Lyme's disease. And I was treated in the hospital, and I got my medicine, and I went home, and everybody said I'd be fine. But I wasn't fine. I wasn't fine. And I'm still got it six years later. So, of course I hated it. Of course I hated it. Duh. You think that after you sit all this time, you won't hate things? Oh, you'll still hate. You'll still hate. So I hated it. But, and I especially what I hated was not so much the disease itself as that my identity is about showing up here every morning. I have been showing up here every morning with a few years off. Since 1975, when we bought this building, I took about 8 years off. But other than that, I've been showing up. So that's my identity, to show up here every morning. And of course, not as a student, but as the guiding teacher. Wow. You know? So my whole identity was messed with, completely messed with. But I had an opportunity to see that, to see how kind of clingy I was and how I had a skin of my identity. Just to see that skin. And then to begin to try to do a different type of meditation because I couldn't come here and sit. I would come here and sit a little bit and then I'd have to go home and go to bed. Sometimes I'd sit and then I'd go to bed. So then I had to spend so much time in bed for several years that I thought, well, you can just humble yourself and do lying down meditation. You know, we emphasize sitting meditation, right? Sitting straight. Our teachers did. Perfect posture, right? You can just do lying down meditation. You know, John Kabat-Zinn taught it. You can do it too. You're not. So I practiced. I saw, oh, I can do lying down meditation. It's not inferior. We always think something's inferior to somebody else, don't we? So I became a lying down meditation master, you guys. You instead of sitting, coming to see me in one-to-one sitting up, we can lie down together. an opportunity that I didn't know. My rigidity about sitting loosened up. No, it's getting rigid again because I'm healthy, you know. Right. But that's all. That's okay. That's the way we are. That's the way we are. And the second opportunity that I got from my Lyme's disease that I didn't know about is that I got an opportunity to retire early from my other job. I mean, I didn't want to retire early, but I realized I had to either either step down from Zen Center, which first I was going to do in the leadership position, or retire from my other job. And now I realize it was a wonderful opportunity. It was wonderful because I get to be here. Heart mind. Practicing with you, sitting with you, talking with you, drinking with you. I mean drinking water and tea. So, however much we create a safe harbor, which we control, only letting so many boats in, keeping the water level such and such, keeping the algae out, the ocean is out there. The ocean is out there. And the ocean's going to come in. The ocean's coming in. Coming in. So we have this precept, which I talked about Wednesday night in Dogen class, that says, do not harbor ill will. Do not harbor ill will. So we harbor our ill will. We harbor it through our memory ghosts, through our desire to control. We harbor it. But sooner or later, the ocean will come in. So why don't we just let it go into the ocean? Why don't we just let it go? We can do that, can't we? Just let it go. It is a big ocean. A huge ocean. Which you can call, I can give it any name you want. Or no name. Just let it go. It's going to come in anyway. So however much we create a safe harbor here at Zen Center in our lives, it only lasts so long. But we can give ourselves to something larger than us. A force, may call it a force, a power. In 12 step they call it a higher power. Or we call it a lower power, or an in-between power, or a powerless power. I don't know. People seem to like to call it a higher power because people like, they think something high is really good. So higher power is fine. Something big. Not the power of control, but the power of freedom. This is the Zen of just being who you are, I guess. Why not? I'm not sure, but how can I be sure? In the big ocean. Who's sure in the big ocean? Which reminds me that when I grew up in California and close to water, and I had and still do have two younger sisters, and my parents were intent on us learning how to swim when we were very young. And one of my sisters learned to swim when she was 3 because they kept putting her in the water. It's just like we keep coming and sitting until some point we let go of harboring all this junk inside and just surrender to the ocean. So my sister learned to swim. It was just in a little pool at 3. And my other sister learned at 4, which was not, I was not happy about. I was not happy about. Because I'm 5 years older than one sister. And what, 2.5 years older than the other one. And I didn't know how to swim. Well, I was scared. I needed a control. I don't want to die. I was smart enough to know that you die. And I don't know why they didn't die. I kept hoping they would. Only when I was at my worst, you guys. But my parents kept putting me in water, giving me extra lessons, group lessons, and then one-to-one lessons. Well, they were pretty intense. Well, my parents were both swimmers. My mother had been an aquatic swimmer. She had swung, water ballet she'd done. My dad was a swimmer, too. So finally, I learned how to swim in this little pool. What a relief. I let God go of control. I trusted enough to learn how to swim. Well, then I heard my parents say, well, now it's time to go to Santa Cruz. I go, well, what's Santa Cruz? And my mother said, well, that's the ocean. Now we're going to swim in the ocean. And I thought, oh, no. I've seen pictures of the ocean. I don't want to swim there. So we started going to the ocean on the weekends, to Santa Cruz. And my sisters learned how to swim in the ocean almost right away. But the ocean is huge. It's not like a little pool. You can't see the bottom. And there's those fish and all that seaweed and all that. And there's even waves in Santa Cruz. Well, my parents would take me to a place where they said there were no waves, but I could see the waves. But finally, you know, I kept doing it, kept doing it. No, swimming in the ocean is one of my favorite things. Obviously, I don't do it too much here in Minnesota. When I'm in places by the ocean, that's what I love to do. So, life may be difficult for all of us. It's hard to control things. We're scared. We're scared of the unknowable, of what's out there, of the fact that everything's in flux, everything is changing. But it can be pretty great, pretty grand, pretty wonderful as we move beyond our fears into this big ocean. This big ocean. So is the ocean, this ocean of life, chaotic? Is it chaotic? In a sense, yes. Because it's completely beyond our control. Stuff's happening that shouldn't be happening. We're doing the same habits over and over that we thought we had changed 5 years ago. People are doing the same stuff to us that they should have changed 5 years ago. How dare they? How dare they? So I've never seen the game on Game of Thrones on television, but my friends have told me about it, and I went online to read something about it, and I read a quote from the screenwriter of for Game of Thrones. He says, What do we have when we abandon the lie? Chaos. That's what he says. So the lie is those skins. Those skins, that's the lie. And chaos, is it something bad? Is it something bad? What did Trungpa Rinpoche say? We should learn to see chaos as extremely good news? That's what he said. Most of our lives we're pushing against chaos. Our plans are going awry. Our backup plans are going awry. Our backup to our backup plans are going awry. We're pushing against chaos. Chaos is interrupting the established. But you know what? It's clearing the way. It's clearing the way for new possibilities that we didn't know. So in the Hindu triumvirate, we have Brahma, the creator god. We've got Vishnu, the preserver god. And we've got Shiva, the god of chaos, the destroyer. So, Shiva is known for sowing discord, for sowing anarchy, and he's rarely appreciated in the moment. I didn't appreciate getting Lyme's disease at all. And I still don't appreciate it, but it gave me opportunity, really. To go deep below these skins, deep. So we could say that we hate Shiva, we hate the destroyer. But the destroyer levels things for Brahma to come up, for our creativity, the new possibility to come up that we didn't know about. It's always here. Whether it's a fender bender or Lyme's disease or something else. It's always here. So, given lemons, we make lemonade. And we can help our friends do this, too. We can help our friends deal with this everything changing and how hard it is and how upsetting it is. We can help our friends. And here's what the Catholic mystic Henry Nouwen says about this. He says, the friend who can be silent with us in a moment of despair, and despair comes when we've lost control. We can't control anything. We're ready to give up. The friend who can be silent with us in a moment of despair, who can tolerate not knowing. And everything changing, how can we know? How can we know? Who can tolerate us not healing and face us with the reality of our powerlessness is the friend who cares. The friend who cares. We can say those two hearts joining, but really they were never separate, because within this little heart are all the hearts. But that's the two hearts realizing that they're not separate, right? That they are separate but not both, right? So now I want to talk about a couple practices to help us shed our skins. Just for 5 minutes or so. To help us shed our skins of memory ghosts, of denial, or over-apologizing, of being judgmental, and of thinking we can control everything and resist change. And the first one is responding to the good and bad things that happen with humor. With good humor. So there's some research on brainwave frequencies that's been done recently on people who meditate. You know, they've been doing this research on people who meditate all over the place. But they recently did some research that I read about with those who were experiencing humor. And what did they find? They found a similarity in the brain frequencies of people who were in meditation to those who were experiencing humor, experiencing laughter or humor. Well, that's interesting. That's interesting. And of course, in India, there's not much. In Indian Buddhism, there's not much humor. There's not much. But in Chinese Zen, everybody's telling jokes. Everybody's telling jokes all the time. In Japanese Zen, everybody's telling jokes, so we get to do that in America too, right? Ooh. The belly laugh in Chinese Zen. All the Chinese guys, you know, running around doing absurd things, clowning around with our bellies, laughing in their bellies. This is the hara in Japanese Zen. This is where our breath of life is. It's our power. So the Chinese Zen master Shui Lao said, ever since my teacher kicked me in the chest, I've been unable to stop laughing. I'm sure there's a huge story behind that, but that's we won't get into that now. So, freed from our skins, we let spontaneity let loose. This is just being who we are, or being just who we are. So, Ho Tai, the happy Chinese monk who carries a sack around him with him full of oranges and gives oranges to kids and to adults, charges them a penny or whatever the equivalent is. So he's pictured, you can see him in Chinese Zen, he's pictured with his bag and, you know, giving. But then later pictures of him, and he's always smiling. Later pictures of him, they're just one brush stroke, like this. It's just a smile, just that, the whole thing. And my first teacher, Suzuki Roshi, I talk about this in my book. You can read about it if you want to. People did things to him. I won't tell examples because I'm running out of time. And he would just laugh. He would just laugh. Now, maybe not always. And I understand when he was a younger man, he was not like that. But by the time I knew him, My teacher, Katagiri Roshi, the founder of this center, I think it's upstairs, there's a picture of him, maybe in Kim's office, where he's just a huge grin on his face. Huge grin. Nothing but a grin. Nothing but a grin. So instead of crying over spilt milk, oh, we can cry over spilt milk. Cry it all you want. But then we smile as we clean it up. We smile as we clean it up. So in the second thing that I think is important, practice to help us shed our skins, is one that won't surprise you, and that's having downtime. We don't. This culture has gotten kind of weird. You know, when I was in the sixth grade, my teacher told me that when I was in another 25 or 50 years, instead of people working 40 hours a week, they'd be working no more than 20 to 25. Instead of only having 3 weeks vacation, they'd be taking 3 months vacation because of technology. But what's happened? It's gone the other way. What's the deal here? Who have we let do this to us? Well, we can blame them, but we've done it to ourselves, haven't we? We've done it to ourselves. Do you know that I read a survey of people who work in businesses or corporations and have paid vacation, that more than 50% of them don't use all their paid vacation in 2015. I cannot imagine that happening when I was a kid. What's the deal here? What are we up to? Where are we going? We need downtime. We need downtime. And by downtime, I mean time without a lot of radio. A little radio is okay, so maybe soft music. Without a lot of TV, without a lot of iPhone, without a lot of reading. A little reading, fine. Sitting with the sutras, that's cool. But not a lot of reading. We need downtime to see these skins and see through them. And we need that. We need sacred time, too. Sacred. Doesn't have to be sacred with a capital S, just a small s, sacred. Turn some of your downtime into sacred time. Time where you're really still. And it doesn't have to be zazen, it's sitting here. Could be sitting by the lake just for 20 minutes every day. Every day. It needs to be a routine that you do every day. And the more, the better. When I was young, it was so much easier. I sat 2 hours a day in meditation for years and years and years. But the culture was different then, wasn't it? And actually, I was going to say I didn't have children, but I did. Now, my wife is probably still not so happy about that. It's too late. It's over now. So, you know, she's got to deal with me now. Sorry for the editorializing. But and sacred space. Create a sacred space. It doesn't have to be Zen or Buddhism. You don't have to have a Buddha statue or some lineage papers. If you have those things, if they help you, do those things. But a sacred space. Space in your house that you keep clean, or you have a picture of somewhere or something, or you have that moves you. Just some flowers. The flower arrangement around here, it just so deeply moves me under Pamela's leadership. And I understand there was a flower arrangement workshop yesterday.
It was great.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. Well, flowers, just flowers, or being by a lake. If you want to get this, you have to build this into your life daily. Downtime, sacred time, and sacred space. But not fancy sacred, just sacred. Do you know what I mean? So yesterday my grandkids went to the farmer's market with my son, and they came home with flowers for grandma. And there were two sunflowers. They each had a little sunflower, and they each had a little something else and a little something else, and they put them in the dining room table for grandma to see when she came down. And grandma came down and saw them, and she got a little teary because she was moved. She was moved. Doesn't have to be much, but you have to do it. You have to commit yourself to it. sacred space, sacred space. And we use that time to see and let go of our skins, but not in some kind of manipulative way, not trying to get anywhere, because then it becomes not sacred, just to be with whatever, just to be with it. If you have to grieve, grieve. If you have to plan your day, well, give yourself 2 minutes to plan your day or something. I'll give myself 2.5 minutes to plan my day, then I'll come back to this. Maybe take a watch. Do something so that it can really be sacred time. And it could be doing lying down. It doesn't have to be sitting, Zazen. It doesn't have to be. You can peel these skins away. You can. And as we do this and the skins peel away, we're better able just to be with what is, just to appreciate what is, whether it's good, bad, or in between. And our Joseph Campbell says that then we're able to follow our bliss. And I like that, but my problem with that is that it's not always... Well, Dogen says we follow our dim vision, or Katagiri, or Suzuki, our dim vision. So our bliss, it's what we really care about doing. But it doesn't necessarily make us blissful. It's what we really care about, what we really want to do in the short time we have. It's a short time we have here, very short time. But if we don't spend time in a sacred space, we can't discover that. We can't discover that. So if we do that, we begin to fall in love with being alive. And we can be a cold Buddha when it's 30 below and a hot Buddha when it's 110 degrees. And that, then we have some, what Katagiri Roshi used to say, spiritual security. That's the Zen of being just who you are. Just who you are. Okay, so I've got about 5 minutes for questions or comments or whatever. Larry.
How would you say that chaos...
Who?
How would you say that chaos that you spoke of earlier relates to the way in Zen?
Well, we interpret change as chaos when it's not the kind of change we like. So there's no absolute chaos. It's just the change that we don't like. It's chaos. So we notice our interpretation, we notice that everything is changing, and we say, oh, I'm labeling that as chaos because I hate it. I hate getting Lyme's disease. Then not having it go away, and the doctors say it's never going to go away. Never going to go away? Larry, can't you help me on this? Can't you take me to another doctor? You know, so it's chaos. But it's been an opportunity for me, and I'm sure it will. In other ways that I don't know. That I don't know. Come on.
I've got a how-to question.
Sure.
I have seen how open-hearted you are with people who have differing opinions than you do. And I aspire to that. I love your talk so much. And so my how-to question is about, I'll give you an example. I was at Orchestra Hall, and... waiting for a friend before the concert, and a woman who was also waiting for a friend started chatting with me, and she quickly went into ranting about burkas. And
doing what?
Burkas, how terrible burkas are.
Oh, okay.
And so I, I don't know how to respond to that. Well, I can't even think that quickly on my feet anyway. So I always, my first thing, Minnesota Nights kicks in, and very often I don't say anything, and people walk away thinking that I agree with them. So I'm wondering, like, with your Vietnam war-loving how this is my how-to question. So, like, when he started going off, and you said you didn't say anything, how did you not say anything? Because, I mean, we have to say something. Did he think you agreed?
Well, I, I don't think there's a pat answer to this. This is a very good question, but I don't think there's a pat answer. And I can tell you what happened to me in those circumstances, but what's generalizable? Every situation's unique, so this may or may not be generalizable, what I'm going to say, to your situation. Certainly not to being with that stranger. It's not generalizable to that. But here's somebody I was going to be with for a long time. And I knew that starting to get into a debate with him about Vietnam was not cool. Just was not cool. It was not going to facilitate. We had a mission together. So instead, I started talking to him about the mission, about how I felt about these people being dispossessed and what opportunity we have. And he joined in. I mean, he wouldn't have gone. He talked about his camera, how he was going to use his camera. And so I just saw that, and I was able to do that. Sometimes we fail, but there's always a chance. I mean, I could have argued with him, I suppose, and then later made up. I mean, I'm living with a guy. We're in the same room. So it's a great opportunity to practice Zen, to practice just being. And sometimes I, you know, so that's about all I can say, Pamela. But that kind of thing that you're talking about is awkward. It is awkward.
Well, that's a wonderful technique. I love that, the diversion, because then you don't have to respond.
Yes, but see, in my situation, I had a mission that he had. In this situation, what are you guys are going to see the same thing at orchestra hall or something?
She was just a woman sitting there.
Yeah, so I don't know. I think you did fine. You did fine. Sure. Yeah.
Can you talk about when there's what we perceive as chaos, usually our amygdala gets triggered.
Yes.
We're not our best selves at all.
That's right.
We're
yes.
uptight. And
yes.
So can you talk about how to relax in those situations where you really, where relaxing would be the best.
Yes. Well, I can. I will talk for 1 minute about it, but I'm a little bit over time here. So, again, is there a how-to? Is it a technique that you can do? Well, you can do a technique, but usually you're so overheated, a technique you're going to forget to do the technique. So I just think the commitment has to be to doing the practice every day of putting yourself in a sacred space and having sacred time every day, so then it begins to carry over. It begins to carry over enough that you can see when the amygdala fires up without just immediately going into a frenzy. You can just see it. You can just be with it. But to try it as a strategy without steeping yourself in the quietness, you can try it, but it's hard. It's hard. And it's even hard. It's even hard when after you've been meditating for 84 years, you know. But it's wonderful because we can do it. We can do it. I think that's all I have time for.
Mm-hmm.